Well, thanks so much. Yeah, so thanks so much for coming out to hear me talk today. And today I'd like to tell you about some work I've entitled it Predictions for Quantum Gravitational Signatures from Inflation. So this is going to be like a hybrid, you know, it's coming from a high energy physics, kind of quantum gravity background, but veering into some cosmology. And like, I'm kind of excited because I'm hoping that, you know, this will very soon actually makes contact with late data, which as a high energy theorist, information theorist, that's like kind of novel and neat for me. But yeah, but anyways, so this is work that I did with Achim Kempf, who's actually just over here at Waterloo, and Peter Simigia, who's a grad student at UBC. And right, I guess I'll begin. The mouse shows up, right? All right, okay, good. So I'll just start with a little bit of introduction, but please, I'll preface this too. I mean, it's an informal group meeting, so just interrupt me whenever you want to ask questions. We'll get through as much as we get through in the talk. All right, so I'd like to start with the following little observation, which is that quantum gravity is very hard to detect experimentally. This is due, in most cases, to the extreme separation of scales that exists between the scale of quantum gravity, so presumably the Planck scale, and the scales we typically access in laboratories. So for example, just to drive this home, if we look at a Large Hadron Collider and compare the scales of Planckian physics to that of the LHC, these are separated by about 15 orders of magnitude. All right? And so now our aim is to look for Planckian physics in some accelerator-based experiment at the LHC, the Planck scale effects are going to be suppressed like the ratio of these scales, the Planck scale to Hubble scale to some power, which this, I mean, even in the best case of like an order one power here, yeah, this is pretty bad. This is hard to detect. So message is quantum gravity, seeing this oscillationally is really, really hard. Yes?
There is no intermediate scale for quantum gravity, like in large x dimensions, for
example. Yeah, that's true. So this is supposing that, you know, really we're looking for effects that kick in at Planckian energy scales. Then you have 15 orders of magnitude to cross at the LHC. Could be that there's stuff in between. There's probably stuff in between. Could even be that gravitational effects become more important earlier on. And in fact, later I'm going to be more agnostic about where quantum gravity starts to become visible. But just here, for the purposes of being dramatic, I'm gonna show you like Planck scale, 15 orders of magnitude. That's really hard. That's bad. However, the scales are much closer in the early universe. And to illustrate that, I'd like to just go through what's essentially a back-of-the-envelope calculation, just some estimates here. So let's look at the primordial scalar power spectrum that one would calculate from CMB measurements, let's say. So that's this quantity, delta r squared of k. And I've written out here in this first line the observational parameterization that we measure. So it's given by there's some overall amplitude, and then the scalar spectral tilt. Right, this is what we measure. And at the same time, we can compare this to the theoretical prediction coming from the theory of inflation, which is given in terms of essentially the Hubble parameter at horizon crossing. Right, so we have these two parameterizations. What I'm saying is let's just equate them, all right? Let's equate them and solve for the ratio of the Hubble scale to the Planck mass, all right? This is a measure of the ratio of the Planck scale and the Hubble scale. So by equating them and just doing the baby algebra, you get this expression for the ratio of Hubble to Planck mass. And if you plug in numbers, reasonable numbers that we estimate from measurements of the CMB, this ratio at horizon crossing works out to be about 5 times 10 to the minus 6, for pretty much the full range of modes that is visible to us in the cosmic microwave background. So this is a lot larger than 10 to the minus 15. So one might hope that, okay, perhaps signatures of quantum gravity, hopefully they scale with some favorable power of this ratio of Planck to Hubble scales, which is controlling the size of these effects in the CMB. So maybe this is a well-motivated idea, but if you ask this question, this just brings about two new questions, which are, well, first, what effect should we look for in the CMB, in particular lacking you know, a preferred or the theory of quantum gravity that we have to look for? What do we look for in the CMB? What sort of effect should we look for? And second, well, what is its observational signature in the CMB? So the basic idea, I'll give you a summary of the basic idea that I kind of want to talk about today and get across. What we're going to do is we're going to, as our starting point, we'll point out that GR and QFT, together, they work really, really well for the theory of cosmological perturbations and giving a, I guess, postdiction for the statistics that one measures in cosmological observables. So instead of starting from the bottom up and picking some theory of quantum gravity, looking for how this would manifest in the present day, we're going to instead focus on minimally modifying the apparatus of QFT on curved spacetime. So then, the question that I'd like to ask is, well, what are the most dominant corrections to this apparatus as the Planck scale is approached from below, from lower energies? And so, again, instead of picking a specific theory of quantum gravity, we're going to focus on some very generic predictions of quantum gravity that are largely model independent. And the one that I'm going to focus on today is the idea that distance should break down at short scales. Or in other words, the idea that presumably some quantum field theory on curved spacetime that's informed by quantum gravity should come with a natural ultraviolet cutoff. Natural to distinguish it from a technical regulator where you put in a cutoff to regulate infinities and some calculation. No, this is the idea that this is motivated by some underlying UV physics. And what's more, we're going to want to do this all covariantly. At a practical level, so as not to contaminate potential observational signatures with signals that come through from having broken diffeomorphism invariance, and also at a practical level, I don't know if I just said in principle or practical. Maybe it's two practical points. But either way, we don't want to introduce contaminations due to breaking general relativistic covariance. And also, it turns out that insisting on general covariance is actually very restrictive and like really focuses in what your prediction is going to be at the end of the day for what to look for. So that's the basic idea. And the key messages of this talk that I'd like to get across are that we're going to figure out what the signature is of a covariant natural ultraviolet cutoff in primordial power spectra that one can deduce from measurements of the CMB or in principle also large-scale structure. The predictions will be quantum gravity model independent in the sense that I was just explaining now, and also inflation model dependent in the sense that I'm not going to be insisting on a particular form of the inflationary potential. Okay, I am assuming inflation is kind of baked into this a proposal. I don't know the story to tell. I don't know how to tell the story in alternatives to inflation, but so it's going to be assuming that inflation took place. And I think it also, I haven't thought about how to go beyond single field inflation, but aside from that, I don't really care what the inflationary potential is. The second key message is that this natural ultraviolet cutoff that we're going to look for is squeezed on both sides. So by that, I mean that if we think of the cutoff as a length, it should be larger than the Hubble length seen by modes during inflation, because otherwise, if you take the cutoff scale to the cosmological Hubble scale, this grossly alters your prediction for what the primordial power spectra should look like. And then just on very general quantum gravitational grounds, we don't expect it to really lie beyond the Planck length, smaller than the Planck length. Maybe it could be parametrically just a little bit smaller, but that kind of sets the upper bound of the scale. The message here is that, well, this cutoff scale is squeezed on both sides, and precision cosmology, therefore, will bound this scale, this cutoff scale, at which quantum gravity effects start to kick in. In fact, it already bounds it, because if you take this cutoff scale to be all the way at your Hubble scale, again, like this is kind of just immediately ruled out by the fact that you get a prediction that looks nothing like the primordial power spectra that we measure. The last key message is that this prediction that we're going to, for what to look for in the CMB, is highly specific. Just to let you know what it's going to be, you'll find that these sorts of cutoffs result in a one parameter or a pattern of oscillations that are superimposed on the conventional primordial power spectrum. It's parameterized by one parameter, just the location of this cutoff scale at which quantum gravity becomes important. Immediately, because of this, it's not too hard, from what I understand, to go into CMB likelihood codes and add like just an extra parameter. In principle, this also opens up the possibility of further increasing sensitivity by allowing yourself to do template matching techniques, kind of similar to what's done in gravitational wave detections. But again, we can discuss that a little bit later. The message I want to get across is that this thing is very, it's a highly specific signal to look for, and there's not really too many knobs to turn, which is kind of nice from the perspective of if you want to actually like sift through data to try and find this. Are there any questions so far? Yes? No? All right, because that was the introduction. And if everyone's, well, if not happy, at least tolerant of what I've said so far, I'll go ahead and now just start talking first about, okay, what actually is this quantum gravity-informed thing that we're going to look for? So I'd like to talk about covariant natural ultraviolet cutoffs. So a generic expectation from most theories of quantum gravity is that the notion of distance should break down at fine enough distance scales. You shouldn't have like a nice, smooth, well-defined notion of like smooth space-time all the way down to Planckian scales and beyond. You might have heard of this called by several names. For instance, you might have heard this called a finite minimal length scenario, or to use the terminology that I'm using today, a natural ultraviolet cutoff for your theory. And there's many ways that you can just kind of heuristically motivate this breakdown of distance. One way they particularly like is the following, which is it's kind of an operational way to motivate it. So suppose that you want to do some experiment where you measure a very, very fine feature, right? Suppose you're measuring some very fine feature of characteristic scale delta x, and you really want to drive that precision down, 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 down to small scales. So if you do that, if you reduce your length uncertainty via the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you're going to be increasing the momentum uncertainty in this region of space-time where you're conducting your measurement. But if you do so, due to Einstein's equations, well, an uncertainty in the momentum of a local region of space-time is equivalent to an uncertainty in the curvature of some local region of space-time. But then, due to just, well, geometry, if you're not certain about how space and time curve in a region, you're not certain about what lengths are in that region of space-time. And so this serves to increase, make your measurement's precision worse. You can imagine iterating this argument over and over again, and what you conclude is that eventually you hit a block, kind of a smallest scale beyond which you just can't further resolve features. So again, operational motivation for there being some finite minimal length scale beyond which you're not entitled to think of there being nice smooth geometry that you can resolve arbitrarily well. Alternatively, if you just want to motivate this really, really quickly, you just say, well, okay, ask Planckian energy densities, you make black holes. Right. So that's nice, but we want to model this sort of minimal length scale covariantly, right? Again, because we'd like to avoid down the line any contaminations that might be due to having broken local Lorentz covariants, which does produce spatial signatures if you do this. It's a different thing. We don't want to look for these sorts of things. So then the question I want to pose is, how do you make minimal length covariant? And to answer that question, and you might have heard this before if you heard Achim give talks around here, one nice way to do this is by generalizing the notion of a maximum frequency. In other words, generalizing the notion of a band limit. So, all right, for example, suppose we just have some 1D function, f of x, function on the real line. Suppose we write it in terms of its Fourier transform, f of k, and suppose that this Fourier transform has compact support, that it's only supported on some finite range of frequencies going from minus omega to plus omega. Right? It should be uncontroversial to you that this maximum frequency omega sets a smallest length scale, right? These are the shortest wavelength waves that make up this function. Now, the observation I would like to make is the following. On one hand, a frequency is well a frequency, but I also want to advance the view that a frequency we can think of as the eigenvalue of a differential operator. So by that I mean if we take these plane waves, u, v, I, k, x, act on them with the derivative operator, the wave operator on the real line, minus dx squared. Well, okay, fine. First year calculus. It's this k squared. The wave number here is the eigenvalue of this operator. And so, if this Fourier transform has compact support, this eigenvalue is therefore bounded for this function. It lies. this function only receives contributions from eigenfunctions whose eigenvalues are in the range 0 to omega squared. This maybe seems like an unwieldy generalization, but it's a nice one because it can be generalized to, you can generalize it to higher dimensions, you can generalize it to this idea to Riemannian manifolds, and you can generalize it to arbitrary Lorentzian manifolds too. Namely, here what we do is we just restrict the spectrum of the scalar D'Alembertian, which I'll denote by box here. So again, to be pedantic and really drive this home, the analog on some arbitrary Lorentzian manifold is we'll look at fields phi of x whose support in the space of eigenfunctions of the D'Alembertian are restricted to only those eigenfunctions whose eigenvalues lie in some compact interval, minus omega squared to plus omega squared, right? You'll notice here that I've added negative values because the D'Alembertian in space-time is not positive definite. But, well, what can I say? This is something you have to do. Is that a question I see forming? Okay. Right. So that's a proposal that a covariant natural ultraviolet cutoff that captures the notion, so something that captures the notion of a minimal length scale, but that's also covariant, we can take this to be a cutoff on the spectrum of the scalar D'Alembertian. So given some Lorentzian manifold M, metric G, we'll define this, we'll let Bm of omega denote the space of fields on this manifold spanned by eigenfunctions of D'Alembertian, whose eigenvalues are less than some, whose absolute value of the eigenvalues are less than some cutoff scale omega squared. This is what we'll call the allowed set of configurations on this Lorentzian manifold.
So how much is sensitive to the boundary conditions?
It is somewhat sensitive to the boundary conditions. This is a good point, and I'll come back to this a little bit later, but that in order to do this, you have to have a well-defined self-adjoint D'Alembertian, which... I think that's one way to think of it. Depending on the manifold, for example, if you were to do this in Minkowski space, then the differential expression you write down just gives rise immediately to an essentially self-adjoint operator. So there's no need to specify extra boundary conditions, for example, in Minkowski space. But generally, where we're going with this for an FLOW spacetime, the thing you write down is not immediately a self-adjoint operator, and so you do need some kind of generalized boundary condition at essentially, the Big Bang. Within this formalism here, this boundary condition for the Sturm-Liouville eigenvalue problem ends up being equivalent to a choice of vacuum state for your scalar field on the manifold, and I'll repeat this again, but we're just gonna choose a bunch Davy state for now. But in principle, this is something that you could explore. You this is a knob that you could turn. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So
question.
For the boring case of Minkowski space.
Yeah.
Box phi is zero for a massless field. So what does it mean to restrict the fully lying value?
Ah, so that would be.
Degenerate because every state gives you zero.
Right. So that's in particular. This is the on shell configuration. I'm going here, the very next slide is going to answer your question, so let me maybe just hold that thought. I'll get through the slide and I'll come immediately to it. All I want to point out on the rest of the slide is that this is it's a fully covariant prescription, just manifestly because the spectrum of a differential operator is a coordinate invariant object. This is just a list of numbers. It doesn't depend on how we coordinatize a manifold. And I'll just make the comment here that there's a very nice information theoretic interpretation of what this maximum eigenvalue is. It's not immediately clear how to think of this in terms of the length scale, but it turns out you can think of this in a very precise way as a cutoff in the density of field degrees of freedom in space-time. And the way to do this is with Shannon sampling theory. I'll just toss it out here, and if you would like to hear more, if there's time at the end, I can go back and go through this. But that's the point I want to make. Think of this as almost like a space-time frequency that limits the density of degrees of freedom in space and time at the same way. Such that if you do pick any coordinate frame and do a 3 plus 1 decomposition, densities of information will transform covariantly. But to get to your question, so how do we actually implement this thing? The way we'll do it is via the field theoretic path integral, all right? And so this speaks to your point. So for example, let's suppose we wanted to look at the Feynman propagator and ask, how does this change with this prescription for a natural UV cutoff? So one could write down a path, the usual expression for the path for the Feynman propagator in terms of path integrals. Just looks like a path integral with two field insertions. By saying we would like to implement a covariant natural ultraviolet cutoff means that we're going to discard these transplanckian beyond cutoff scale contributions from the path integral. So exactly as you were saying, the on-shell configuration, I mean, let me go to just skip to the next slide. For a massless scalar field, the on-shell configuration is just the field configuration for which box phi is zero. In the path integral, it receives all these contributions from fields that have box phi not equal to zero. And in principle, just according to vanilla conventional QFT, you receive contributions from like box phi equals lambda phi for arbitrarily large lambda phi. So one way of interpreting what we're doing here is to say that we're going to discard the most off-shell, in other words, quantum, in other words, quantum gravitational contributions to the path integral. Where I've snuck in the word gravitational there because we're saying, okay, the scale at which we start throwing things out is Planckian. Does that answer your question?
So,
yeah.
I'll ask again
later. Okay. Right. But yeah, so what we're doing is... Oh, yes. Yes, voice from above.
So this is I was just... so this is, of course, in Euclidean space, this is kind of the usual, the kind of standard way to cut off the path integral to put it.
Yes, that's right.
Where box is equal to lambda squared.
Yeah, that's right. So
and then one, let's say, defines it in Euclidean space, and then whatever you get there, the cutoff path integral one imagines sort of analytically, you know, quick rotating back to the result back to Lorentzian space. Do you know whether that would give the same result as imposing the cutoff like this directly in Lorentzian space, or is the idea that it's something different than that?
Yeah. So, caveat is that I don't have like a concrete calculation to back this up, or I haven't sat down and done this, but my expectation is that it actually gives you something different. My intuition for this is just thinking about like just the signal processing, like the sampling theory of Euclidean manifolds versus Lorentzian manifolds, and there's not a clear relationship between the sampling theory of like some signal in space and time and its Euclidean counterpart. But yeah, that's a good question, and off the top of my head, I think that it's different, but yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, certainly though, I mean, this thing, like these eigenvalues have a dimension of mass. This would be like, you just take this lambda over to the other side, you have like box minus lambda phi equals zero. These would be like virtual masses that you're fluctuating over in the path integral, including negative mass squareds. But right, so that was one comment. The other comment I'd like to make, which I'll come back to this later, is that what I've been telling you about so far, this is a very sharp cutoff where we're saying, okay, precisely when you hit this eigenvalue of this differential operator, contributions sharply turn off past this point. You throw everything out. When you throw everything out, you can soften this cutoff, and I'll come back to this a little bit later when it is more appropriate to do so. It's challenging to soften this directly within the path integral, but I'll come to this later when it's easier to, where it's more, there's a more natural way to soften these cutoffs. Further questions? This ends the section on the cutoffs and the kind of the quantum gravity motivated side. The next one I'm going to talk about is the calculation that we did and that I'd like to tell you about. So the end goal of this program is that we want to look for signatures of this kind of quantum gravity-motivated Planck scale cutoff in the cosmic microwave background. or in principle, the any large-scale structure, some other cosmological observable, but I think this is maybe the most reasonable starting point. And today, what I'd like to do is compute corrections to the primordial power spectrum. I'm going to focus on scalar perturbations, simply because these are perturbations for which we have data. You could do the same calculation for the tensor perturbations. It's totally analogous, but I want to focus on the scalar case because we haven't measured tensor perturbations yet. This is plausibly something we could now confront with data. Right. So to that end, I'd like to serve you the primordial power spectrum three ways. So remember, way back from the beginning of the talk, there was this observational parameterization of the scalar primordial power spectrum in terms of an amplitude and spectral tilt. There's a theory expression that we get from working through the theory of cosmological perturbations and standard textbook stuff about inflation. And I'll just point out here, there's this third writing of this primordial power spectrum. It's just a rewriting of the theory prediction, but in terms of the Feynman propagator, or the co-moving curvature perturbation. All right? And this writing is very useful here. It's no accident that I was used the Feynman propagator as an example a couple of slides prior for how to implement this cutoff. Because we'll use that writing to compute what the correction is, the primordial power spectrum. The correction is just going to be the difference between this cutoff Feynman propagator and the conventional propagator with the appropriate prefactor scaling it up. All right. So we have to evaluate path integral. But path integrals are kind of unwieldy. I don't really know how to do this calculation from first principles, only integrate over a certain class of fields. So we're going to use an equivalent definition of this that's a much more amenable to computation. This is it's completely equivalent to taking the conventional Feynman propagator and just acting on it to the left and right with spectral propagators. Spectral projectors. So by projector, I mean this P of omega. And it is, literally a projector. If you act on some test function u of x, the action of this projector is to project out eigenvalues that are larger than the cutoff scale. So really, you act p on u, you take its overlap with an eigenfunction of the D'Alembertian, multiply it by the corresponding eigenfunction, and it gets weighted by this heavy side step function. So retains all contributions below the cutoff scale, and then at the cutoff scale, this drops to zero. Other contributions are discarded. This is where I'd like to make the remark about softening the cutoff. Now you can see how we do this, how one can do this. And it's just by softening out this heavy side step function. So by smoothing out into something that turns on gradually, you can turn the sharp cutoff into something more soft. So in a sense, this gives you a class of cutoffs that you can look at, parameterized by functional degree of freedom. You can even do like wild stuff if you want. Like, it doesn't even have to be like in any sense a cutoff. You could like enhance the Planckian sector if you wanted. You can make it do like weird oscillatory things, but I don't know how to interpret that. So generally when I say cutoff, I'm gonna mean something that like looks kind of like a cutoff. It's like mostly zero below some scale, mostly one past some scale. But I don't know. In principle, you could go nuts and do weird things. For now, though, I'll continue to focus on the case of the sharp cutoff for the practical reason that this is like there are the fewest parameters that you must specify in order to say what's going on. And it's going to give like a very crisp signal to look for. But I'll comment on this briefly at the end. So in principle, the actual calculation to compute this correction is quite straightforward. The inputs to the calculation are an FLRW scale factor, A of eta. So you have to specify what this background inflationary manifold is. And implicitly, again, I'm making the assumption that this is all in single field inflation. So I just have this this one Mohanov-Sasaki variable to worry about. This is my scalar field on the FLRW manifold. Given this as input, yes, question.
It's not your scalar field, right? Sasaki variable is some combination of metric perturbations and a scalar perturbation.
That's right.
It's not supposed to have a covariant. Covariant equation of motion because you already fixed it's written in, well, it's some funny combination of metric and field variables. So I don't really know what equation.
I thought the point was to identify this gauge invariant combination of the two of this gauge invariant, the single scalar degree of freedom that exists in the theory.
It is, but I guess The point is that you go when you put this cutoff, you in some level you go beyond linear theory, and I mean that's what my
so thought. Yeah, so that is an important point. I'm not going beyond linear theory. Now, at the very end, I will maybe make like a throwaway comment about how you might think about this in terms of like the theory of the effective field theory of inflation, in terms of like a manifestly nonlinear theory. But kind of one point of all this is that it's really all free field theory. It's all free field theory, except for the fact that we're doing this thing that where we discard.
But it's not free. Like it has this. It has a mass. But okay, it's free field theory,
yeah.
But not a, I guess, massless.
Yeah, it's a massless free field theory.
Non-dependent mass, I guess that's what I'm, right?
No, I mean it really is a massless free field theory.
But the vacuum Lacanov variable is like a double prime over a mass.
In that sense, yes.
That's the sense in which I'm saying it's not covariant because it has a time-dependent mass.
I see.
Even at the linear level.
Right, or I mean, okay, let me, I guess, so when I say it's covariant, you could have picked another frame and given this variable, made it look like this variable has some totally different time-dependent mass. In principle, it will give you the same answer. Yeah, I think, and so it doesn't care that we've... It doesn't care what frame you pick to actually do the calculation. It will give you the same answer in any frame. Mm-hmm. Right, and so with these inputs, the calculation is, well, in principle, rather straightforward. There's three steps. You write down the Feynman propagator for the co-moving curvature perturbation. You, given this manifold, solve the Sturm-Liouville eigenvalue problem to construct these spectral projectors. And then step three, you act left and right on this propagator to compute the correction, and there, you have your answer. And in this calculation, the cutoff scale omega, this is an unknown parameter, in the sense that this is not an input to the calculation, and not something that we're going to fix a priori. This is something that is really, I mean, really, it's to be fixed by comparing with data. Right? We expect that it should be larger than Hubble scale, but smaller than, or at most at Planck scale, but this is something we'd like to pin down in data. And in comparing this to CMB data, this is what we'd like to kind of constrain. All right, so first point, well, how am I going to fix this FLRW geometry? The strategy that we're going to pursue here is to recall this comparison we made between the observational and theoretical parameterization of the primordial power spectrum. So just according to conventional physics, again, we have these two ways of writing the primordial PPS, the PPS. And so we can solve this for the Hubble parameter seen by mode at horizon crossing. And this is what I'm going to take as my specification of the FLRW manifold. Okay? Just what we determine this to be from measurements. So it's given in terms of the measured primordial power spectrum and slow roll parameter. All right, and this is why I'm not going to be assuming like a model of inflation. I'm just saying let's just take this as the input for the background manifold. Now there are some subtleties to the calculation, some of which were preempted, some of which you preempted. One subtlety is that the exact FLRW computations are pretty intractable, even if like it turns out you have something like a power law manifold. These are very hard problems that can't be solved in closed form, but you can do very well by doing a sort of adiabatic de Sitter approximation. So I mean, schematically, what we do is we say, okay, well, suppose you have some background manifold that has a de Sitter-like scale factor, but just let the Hubble parameter vary slowly according to this observational parameterization given on the previous slide. Turns out you do very well with this approximation. All your errors are suppressed by like, quadratic and higher powers of slowable parameters, and also, again, preempt a little bit where I'm going, any error ends up being non-oscillatory. The final signal you wind up with is oscillatory, so okay, that's a good thing. And the second point, this comes to your question about choice of boundary conditions. The choice of the vacuum state ends up being in one-to-one correspondence with the choice of self-adjoint realization for this D'Alembertian box. In other words, one must specify generalized boundary conditions for box as a differential expression in order to wind up with a well-posed Sturm-Liouville eigenvalue problem. So, as I was explaining, here we assume we're going to take the Bunch-Davy state for the scalar fluctuations, and this is deduced by comparing an expression for the Feynman propagator in terms of a time-ordered expectation value, just from canonical quantization, to the expression that you would write down just based on functional analysis as the thing that is the inverse of the D'Alembertian. Literally like 1 over lambda ket bra plus homogeneous corrections. With this comparison, you can fix what your eigenfunctions are that correspond to this choice of vacuum. Right. So that was a calculation, and next I'll tell you about the outputs of this calculation. So at the end of the day, when you go through the whole thing, you calculate, you turn the crank, you find that a covariant natural ultraviolet cutoff produces small oscillations that are superimposed on top of the conventional primordial power spectrum. And so again, in the case of a sharp cutoff, for which the signal is crispest and the least number of knobs you can turn, you find that this thing, it's oscillations with a very specific prefactor, all right? So here, C, this is just some order one numerical constant, which I could write out for you in terms of Bessel functions, but it's not very illuminating. Sigma, I'm using to denote the ratio of Hubble and cutoff scales at horizon crossing. And this omega of K, this is the frequency of these oscillations as a function of the mode number K, right? So, okay, that's pretty neat. What do I want to point out about this? These sorts of oscillations, they're chirping log oscillations that are to be superimposed on the primordial power spectrum. So log oscillations, and I haven't spent like a huge amount of time in like the real observational cosmology literature, but I think this is like somewhat standard terminology. Have people heard of this before? Or I'm calibrating like how to talk with different communities right now. So this is all useful data. So by that I mean oscillations that look like roughly constant frequency in log k space. And chirping, by chirping I mean that this frequency over the range of modes that you would see in the night sky, it's approximately constant, but not really actually. It's changing and it visibly changes.
Perhaps I'm not seeing that.
Yeah, so ultimately, if you plotted this as a function of k, which I'll do on the next slide for you, but this frequency here, if you were to write this omega sigma as like something times k, then this log here is gonna give you like a log k in that expression. So if you organize this argument of the sinusoid as something times k, you'll have a log k times a k.
Ah, so it's log k times k.
Wait, hang on.
Just log k.
You'll have something times log k, where that something looks approximately constant, but it is varying, which gives you a chirp. It sweeps out a range of frequencies. Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't see your plot, but yeah, for me it's not obvious where this log
because
you expand this sigma as linear k or how?
That sigma is. I should have written that down there. That sigma is essentially this h. It's h divided by omega. So it's k to some power, which this is the thing because this power, the spectral tilt, is almost one. Like this is almost zero. This is why the frequency is like almost constant.
This thing is almost log.
Yeah. Westerns.
So this is scary to say, but 20 yeah. years ago when I was in grad school, it was scary to say that that was 20 years ago. This question came up, and there was this huge argument of what power of H over the cutoff does the leading order effect come in, and then there was like the transplanted people who said it was one power, and then some other group of people, and then I believe there was Akim at that time, had some similar sounding thing to this, or maybe old Danielson.
Yeah.
It was not this power. I think it was not a fractional power. It was not a fractional power.
Yeah, so
what was wrong with that original stuff?
Right. The short answer I can give to the short answer I gave to that is that these are all non-covariant methods. These are these are largely things that come from very, very respectable work and like the right thing in many senses, like the right thing to do. So I hesitate to say like why that's wrong, but I guess what I'll say is why this is different is because this is kind of being, this falls out from saying we want to do something covariant right from the start and just keeping that as like kind of the guiding principle. I don't know if you want to call it like perverse or humorous that this sigma, essentially sigma to the three halves, kind of like directly interpolates between like the two camps. The two camps are saying like sigma just linear or sigma squared. This is kind of exactly in the middle. I don't know. I'll maybe not comment on like the human nature of this, but just say that this is what the calculation spits out.
Extra log in the denominator, so it's a little bit.
Yeah. So it's not quite sigma to three halves. It's tweaked a little bit, but again, I mean, I don't know. If I put on my astrophysics hat, I think that log of anything is one, so that doesn't change things too much. Especially because, like, I mean, it's slow roll inflation, so the actual ratio of Planck-Hubble scales, it doesn't change by all that much over the range of modes that we see.
About the chirping.
Yes.
Usually means the frequency increasing with time. Here, what does the chirping here mean?
Chirping is a function of the co-moving mode number, K. So it's going to change as a function of mode. It's not just like a monochromatic oscillation.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, question.
How much does the form of this depend on the assumption of like the sharpness of the cutoff?
Right. It depends. It depends on this. Turns out, this frequency is essentially independent of the form of that cutoff. This thing, in fact, like mathematically, when you go through a calculation, you see that this frequency is essentially, provided there is still a well-defined cutoff scale, that you have something that looks like turns on roughly at the scale omega, the frequency is unchanged, the amplitude and phase will drift a bit. So what's nice about the sharp case is that we really just have a single parameter family of predictions to look for. If you solve this cutoff, roughly this turns into a three-parameter family. Now, instead of everything being fixed by this one parameter, you also can let the amplitude and phase float a little bit. That's the extent to which it changes. Maybe another point I can make is as you soften things, the signal does get suppressed. The amplitude goes down, so it gets harder to measure. This is also why. An additional reason why I would advocate looking for the signal produced by the sharp cutoff first. It's very the crispest thing to do, in principle, the biggest signature, it's kind of the easiest thing to constrain. So let's try constraining that first before getting fancy. Yeah. So right, I'd better show you like what actually happens. So here's the sorts of sorts of predictions you would look like. The sorts of predictions you wind up with. So on the left side, I'm showing you what happens if you take the cutoff to be really at the Planck scale. The result is you get a curve that looks essentially like it's the conventional primordial power spectrum, except for if you zoomed in really, really, really closely, you would see small oscillations, fast small oscillations on top of this. It's kind of cool, actually. It really is like a ringing between the Planck and Hubble scales. But these are tiny oscillations. Sigma to the three halves. I mean, it's not great, but not it's not terrible, but not great either. So these are things that are like one part in 10 to the 9 compared to the background power spectrum. On the other hand, in this curve, I've shown you what happens if you take the cutoff to not right at the Hubble scale, because if you take it to the Hubble scale, you get like a wild discrepancy. But this is about, this is almost 2 orders of magnitude away from the Hubble scale. Here you get a curve you get oscillations. It's very long wavelength oscillations. Red is the standard PPS, and blue is the corrected one. So you see here it crosses the standard curve twice here. So very long wavelength oscillations, and amplitude that's even visible by eye. So the conclusion here is that, well, the left case, this is probably imperceptible. For maybe, I don't know, hundreds of years in the future, we get really, really good measurements. On the other hand, the right, or when you take the cutoff like really close to Hubble scale, this is probably too drastic. And so the message is that we can probably already constrain where such a cutoff scale would kick in, and it'd be really neat to do so. And this is like one thing I'm starting to work on now.
I mean, doesn't Planck paper have a constraint in this type of oscillation?
Yes, certainly like log oscillations. This is not a unique feature or proposal. Yeah, I mean, this is something I'm becoming better versed in now. Yeah, I don't know how much can immediately just be ported over to this.
Well, it's already constrained at actually some level of 3%, I think.
And yeah. Yeah. So in particular, I guess why I say I don't. The fact that here, like it's a one parameter curve through the correction space, as opposed to like floating amplitude, frequency, phase, everything is fixed by like it's a one parameter track. So you might be able to do like a little bit better by running it through CMB codes. But yeah, you're right that there are already constraints. So maybe a more precise statement is I don't know how much better you can do with the specificity, but that is a question I'd like to answer. Right, and then I will come back to this point, and I don't need to dwell on the slide for too long, I think, because we've discussed this, that we consider this so far as being the simplest case of just a one parameter sharp cutoff, but in principle you can soften out the cutoff. As I mentioned, the frequency is unchanged, but it damps the amplitude and shifts the phase. The latter I don't think is so important for detectability, but the former, that makes it harder to observe. And right, so again, heuristically, this results in, it's a functional degree of freedom, how you could soften this thing, but heuristically, it's a three-parameter family that you wind up with. Right, so I think it's getting to be about time, so I'll just start wrapping up here. I'll start by flashing, again, this key messages slides, to remind you that what we talked about was looking for the signature of a covariant natural ultraviolet cutoff motivated by quantum gravitational considerations in primordial power spectra. Motivated by quantum gravity, but largely doesn't really care what your underlying UV model for quantum gravity is, provided that it gives you some notion of like a natural ultraviolet cutoff. I mention that because there are models of quantum gravity, these things with like conformal sectors in the far UV, where like you don't have some finite resolvable distance scale. But for many models, this is the natural conclusion you'd arrive at. And again, inflation model independent in that. I don't really care what the inflationary potential is, I just care what the background manifold is. The cutoff scale is squeezed on both sides by the Hubble scale and the Planck scale, and so in principle we can, and I'd like to, bound what the scale is based on data that you see in the CMB. And the prediction is highly specific. It's a one pattern, in the case of the sharp cutoff, a one parameter pattern of superposed oscillations, which, very highly constraining, and this is, I don't know, it's another idea to explore. I'll be embarrassed talking about this if there are people who really know like how to do these calculations, these like template matching calculations, but this is in principle another way to squeeze a little bit of statistical precision out of like noisy signal. You can match to a library of templates the same way that people do these signal matching for gravitational wave experiments. So, right, I'll end by talking a little bit of precision and observational prospects. So this correction, again, ranges from about 1 part in 10 to the 9 for a cutoff really at the Planck scale to really order one modifications when you take this cutoff to the Hubble scale. So at the very least, I think we can constrain this. it's helped by the specificity of the prediction. Meaning in this simplest case, this is one extra parameter to add to a CMB fit. And I don't know, maybe you can gain some additional precision via the technique of template matching. So this is kind of like doing a high low pass filter on a signal. Like if you're looking for a sine wave and some really set of noisy data, and you knew it lay between two, you knew the signal you were looking for is in some frequency band, you could do a high pass and low pass filter outside this band. That's the intuition behind template matching. More generally, construct an orthogonal function space out of this library of templates and project stuff out that's orthogonal to it. Much like as is done in LIGO and other gravitational wave measurements. Some things I didn't talk about were the tensor power spectrum, but the case is pretty analogous. I didn't spend a lot of time talking about the information theoretic interpretation of this cutoff and the associated sampling theory that goes with it, which is neat in its own right and happy to have conversations about. I didn't talk so much about how this relates to the effective field theory of inflation. I can sketch some ideas about how this might relate. I'll invite you to ask me about that if you'd like. And I also didn't go into like really nitty-gritty details of the calculation, which is probably more functional analysis than you want to hear about. Again, I'm happy to talk about all these things offline. I guess I'll end with some questions I have for you, which are just thoughts, comments, impressions on this whole thing, people you think I should talk with, resources to consult. I mean, I'm a theorist. I'm looking for places to begin when it comes to actual data analysis, and strategies going forward. For example, does one better to propagate this prediction forward to directly to the power spectrum measure of the CMB versus compare these predictions to inferred primordial power spectra, or anything really. So I'll end there and open the floor to you. Thanks. Yes, I'll just sweep from right to left.
I have a comment and a question. So comment is that besides CMB, there is large scale structure. There are large scale structure data, which actually can be even more sensitive, perhaps, to this type of
I see.
So it's 3D picture, so uh-huh. Out, like in CMB.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so that's one thing. And another, have you looked at the non-Gaussianity in this? And you get sometimes the model there enhanced.
Right, yeah. So no, I have not looked at the non-Gaussianity, and I think I'll just leave it there. Yeah, this is not something I've calculated. And I'm not I'm honestly not sure how to begin with that.
Well, three-point function.
Yeah. Rather, actually, I've not. Yeah, I need to sit down and spend a little while thinking about how to do this with this formalism. How to convert that into a quantity that's amenable to the functional analysis. Perhaps you can tell me about that. Yeah.
So thinking about like adding features to the small scale primordial power spectrum makes me think a little bit about what people discuss when they are like hunting for like primordial black hole populations. It's probably something that others in the room know more about than me, but is that something that might be an interesting literature?
No, that's not something I've looked at. And when you say small scale, you mean like high K?
Yes.
In that case, yeah. That's not something I'm aware of. I'm like vaguely aware of this, like of there's a huge body of literature on features in the CMB. When it comes to like specific ones, I'm in the process of getting educated.
Maybe return to the point I was making. So it's a bit weird because you have a mass as a scalar, mass as a scalar, which has Matt mentioned, I guess you just have box of y as you call the zero.
Yeah.
But then somehow you get an effect which is maybe not zero.
Yes.
And I wonder whether it just goes back to what I was saying, that is you're not dealing with your scalar, you're dealing with this Sasaki-McConnell variable, which is not a mass as a scalar at this time.
I can say for certain it's not due to that fact, simply because if you did the same calculation, let's say for a massless scalar field in Minkowski, so this really is like some scalar field with zero mass time is time translation invariant, you still get an effect. If you computed this like this power spectrum for Minkowski space, you would see deviation compared to just like the usual power spectrum, which goes like for Minkowski, it's like k one over no, it goes like k cubed or no, yeah, one over k cubed like this.
Right, yeah. I'm on top, I guess, but that's what.
Yeah, doing. Yeah.
I see what you're.
Yeah, it's like I don't know if you want to think of it in like kind of conventional. More conventional perturbative QFT, this would be like, there is probably a way, and this comes to how you would relate this to the theory of the effective field theory of inflation, you'd be messing with like the loops and stuff, because here like we're really doing stuff to like the virtual configurations in the path integral, the stuff that's off shell.
Right, I mean, that's the thing, is that you think for a free theory, nothing is off shell. I mean, why does anything go off shell? But it's, I guess maybe in just in the Feynman prescription, you add this additional thing, which approximate, well, it's not that approximate, it's just an exact but it makes a delta function by an integral over that.
Yeah, and like, I mean, so you have this path integral, so you have that G, it's like an integral over fields, phi x prime, e to the I s, like that, and like what I've been saying is that okay, the operationally this cutoff amounts to now changing this domain of integration, saying we're only going to integrate over some space B like that. But equivalently, like just an equivalent way to write this is to just integrate over the whole space, but now put in like some indicator function. I don't know, call it like pi omega of phi like that, which is one if this thing conforms to the cutoff criterion and vanishes otherwise, which then just rewriting things, write this as d phi phi e to the I like s I minus I log pi of phi. And then like, I think you could then view this as like an action with higher order terms. This is like my idea. This would be my idea of like how to start if you want to relate this to a kind of like an EFT way of thinking. And this is probably, this ends up being like powers, something that's like powers of the D'Alembert operator, some power series that like converges to a projector, something like that. I think that's how it's going to shake out. But again, I haven't done this calculation, so I can't tell you like exactly how it's going to work out. And also that like, this prescription is somewhat different from like the usual EFT way of thinking of things, where it's like you integrate out the UV and look at how this shows up in terms of like some sum of higher order terms with like coefficients that you fix according to your experiment. Whereas here, it's like we're not really integrating anything out; we're throwing stuff out. So yeah, there's a conceptual difference, but these two apparatuses are so general that I wouldn't be surprised if there's some way to like link them up. And describe like what we're doing in one language in terms of the other, and vice versa. Yeah.
Okay. Any more questions? So let's thank our speaker again.
Thanks.